From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. The line between love and hate can be very thin. Maybe there are some things you just can't stand about your husband, even though you love him very much. Or your job drives you crazy, but you wouldn't give it up for anything. Today, we'll explore the paradox of loving what you hate, or coming to hate what you thought you loved. We start with a remarkable confession of one of the most famous athletes of recent years.
I felt like I've been tempted to quit my whole life. I mean, I was tempted to quit as a kid, but was probably too scared, and I was tempted to quit as an adult. I was probably too scared.
Andre Agassi retired from tennis in 2006, leaving behind one of the best records in modern times, including 8 Grand Slam titles. Throughout his career, Agassi was never just another great player. He was a showman from early on, turning heads with his skin-tight denim shorts, not to mention his blistering shots. Later on, he slumped, badly. Then, somehow, managed to climb back on top of the tennis world and became the game's elder statesman. It's a complicated story, Agassi tells, in his candid memoir titled Open, which the New York Times has called one of the most passionately anti-sports books ever written by a superstar athlete. Steve Paulson has played tennis his whole life, and he's always followed Agassi's career with great interest. So he was surprised to learn about Agassi's bitterness toward the sport that made him famous.
On the very first page of your book, you say you hate tennis. You hate it with a dark and secret passion. And throughout the book, you keep saying this to the people who become important in your life. And of course, no one believes you at first when you tell them that you hate tennis. So I guess I have to ask, do you still hate tennis now that you're retired?
No, I do not hate tennis. You know, people say, is it a love-hate relationship? I said, it's more like a hate-love relationship. You know, tennis was something I certainly didn't choose. I didn't choose as a young man. My father kind of pushed it on me. I felt fear to not do it, not in any sort of form of abuse, but in the form of just having the pressure of the world on my shoulders. He introduced me as the future number one player in the world. And then I went to an academy that I hated. It was more like a glorified prison camp, and then my only way out of there was to succeed. So then I succeeded and found myself on a world stage that scared the living daylights out of me, and all of a sudden I'm being judged for many things that I was and wasn't. So I never had ownership of tennis. I was scared later on, then I played because I didn't know what else I was going to do. And it wasn't probably till I was 27 years old that I took ownership of my choices and chose the very thing that I hadn't chosen my whole life. And when that happened, the scales started to get balanced. I started to understand what it was giving me, my school in Las Vegas that I built. It gave me my wife. And it made a lot more sense to me then.
Let me take you back to the early days that you write about with your father and how intense that was. I mean, you talk about how he groomed you to become the best player in the world. And he taught you some things that made you a great player, like learning to take the ball on the rise when you were 7 years old. How did he do that?
Well, he did that by inventing one of the gnarliest looking ball machines you've ever seen. And I nicknamed it the Dragon in the book because it stood in front of me fire breathing, you know, and he pushed that thing as close to the net as possible and had this long aluminum tube necking, and the thing would hold this ball in its throat until the pressure built up so much, and then it would fire out at about 110 miles an hour. And then he would kind of pace behind me back and forth, you know, a bit like a caged lion, kind of making sure I'm staying on the baseline and don't back up, don't let the ball play you, you play the ball, go after it, hit it harder, hit it earlier, you know. And so you learn fundamentals that allow you to deal with those sort of extremes. And as a result, you have the skill set to kind of adjust to the pace of tennis picking up as you get older, and was probably a huge reason for my success in between the lines.
So why do you think your father was so determined to turn you into a great player?
For him, you know, he's from what he calls the old country, and he didn't have a life of choice himself. And he, you know, grew up fighting the world, you know, getting a lot of fights as a kid because of being a Christian Armenian and a Muslim Tehran, getting in a lot of fights because his mother would make him wear hand-me-down girls' clothing as punishment. She was pretty abrasive, pretty abusive in many ways. And so he fought, and then he went into boxing because he realized he was good at it. And as a result, I think he's been fighting his whole life. It's just, you know, the world's against him. And he saw tennis as the quickest road to the American dream and wanted that for his kids. And he brought his intensities and his rage. I mean, anger was a way that he kind of reacted to a lot of things. If he didn't understand his own emotions, he would get upset. And I think that tennis reminded him of boxing without the downside of physical contact.
So were you afraid of your father when you were growing up?
I think you're afraid of any father at 7 years old when you're looking up at this man and you watch him knock somebody out in the middle of a street. You know, I wasn't afraid that he didn't love me. I wish his love was softer. I wish it was just a little less. You know, the intensity of his loyalties were unmistakable. The intensity of how much pride he took in me just has a real healthy power over a young man growing up, but there's a real level of fear as it relates to, you know, watching your dad fight, seeing him get in fights. Also, too, just the mood of the house. If you weren't winning or you weren't practicing well or hard enough or long enough, I mean, it fundamentally unsettled him. And when he was unsettled, everybody around him was unsettled.
Now, you were a Vegas kid, and once you started getting good, you hustled people for money as well. And you have a great story of Jim Brown, the old NFL great who shows up in Vegas and comes to your tennis club and is looking to play for money. Can you explain what happened?
Yeah, it was at my racket club. We go walking into Cambridge Racket Club like we did on most days, and my dad points out Jim Brown and says, "You see who that man is? That's Jim Brown, one of the greatest football players of all time." And I was like, "Whoa, okay." And I'm looking at him, this big man, and he's talking to the manager of the club, who we knew pretty well, and he's upset that a money match fell through. The guy didn't show up, and he wanted somebody to play. He loved gambling. He loved tennis. And my dad steps in and says, "My son will play you." And he says, "If you're looking for a game." And he turns around and says, he kind of snickers and basically says, "You know, I'm looking to play for money." And I says, "Well, he'll play you for your whatever you want." And he says, "You know, I'm talking about real money." He says, "He'll play you for your effing house." And Jim Brown says, "I don't need your house. I got a house. What do you say we play for 10 grand? And says, "Let's go." And I mean, I'm starting to sweat. I'm just standing there, my eyes like saucers, like poker chips, you know. And Jim Brown says, "Not so fast. You need to go home and show me some money up front." And my dad says, "I'll be right back." And he gets in the car and leaves me there, which he used to do a lot of days when he had to go to work. I used to always be there. And Mr. Fong, the manager, used to look out for me. And I used to make sure I was out there practicing. And he comes back with our life savings, with his life savings. And when he shows it to Jim Brown, Mr. Fong is encouraging Jim Brown not to take the bet because he says, "This kid's going to beat you." And
how old were you at the time?
I was 8 years old.
Wow.
Maybe nine, just turned nine. So we go down on the court. He says, "I tell you what, let's play a couple sets and then we'll decide how much to bet." So, you know, I relax, but I kind of, I don't dog it a little bit. I just, not much pressure, but I'm still going to win. And I beat him the first couple sets and he's getting the feeling like this could be tough. But then he decides to bet me 500 for the third set. He thinks I'm probably pretty tired. I'm 9 years old. He's been running me around and I end up beating him worse in the third set. And, never felt so good. When he shook my hand, man, his hand was huge and rough with calluses.
You know, it's a great story, but on the other hand, you were 8 years old or 9 years old. Your father was putting incredible pressure on you. I mean, as you say, you know, betting his life savings on what you were going to do for him.
Yeah, but you know, if you really think about that through a different lens, you know, it's a real conflicting emotion because certainly that pressure feels unreasonable for any child. But at the same time, that pride, you know, that confidence, that belief that he had, it was a bit like a drug. It felt good to have a father that believed that much, but then it felt so bad because you almost wish he didn't, but then you're glad he does. And it was a weird emotion for me.
Hmm. Now, you've talked about how you resented how your whole life had turned into tennis. But on the other hand, it was clear from very early on that you were incredibly gifted and I assume you must have taken pleasure in that skill and enjoyed winning all those tournaments that you did as a junior. Was there a big upside as well?
Well, I think soon you become identified with it. And I think a child winning anything finds some sense of satisfaction. But it was fleeting. You know, that feeling was fleeting. You were always faced with the next challenge. You know, in tennis, you win, and you can win 5 matches and lose one, and you're a loser. You can win 6 matches and lose one, and you're a loser. And you can win a tournament and have to play the next tournament and lose, and you're only as good as your last result. So there was always that never-ending kind of pressure that came along with it that seemed to carry the day at the end.
Now, you talked about then being sent off to a tennis academy, Nick Bollettieri's famous tennis academy. You became his most famous protege. You've described it as like prison camp or maybe boot camp. What was the hardest thing about being there?
Raising yourself, you know, not having any really role models, anybody to really steer, help you make decisions, help you understand things, being so far away from home. All those things were pretty tough, being in a group of kids where it was like Lord of the Flies with tennis rackets. I mean, we raised ourselves. We determined the rules and the pecking orders, and we determined it any way we saw fit. You know, whether who was going to rebel the most, who won the match, how we did with each other on the tennis court tend to dictate how we dealt with each other off the court, which meant winning was the only way to kind of organize in your life, which came with its own pressures and resentments. And then there was just the fundamental practical life of it. It was a boot camp. It was 4 hours of school and 6 hours of tennis. It was that inverse ratio of tennis to school, you know, left you really having to say no to school because you're just too damn tired to even think about it after a while and even care about it.
You became a tennis prodigy, and then you turned professional really early. I mean, you were 16, and you quickly rose up through the rankings. You were labeled the next great hope of American tennis, which I'm sure must have been a burden. You were flashy. Your hair was long. You wore denim shorts. You hit the ball really hard. And then you did that famous commercial for Canon Camera where you say, "Image is everything." And that, of course, became the rap against you. Did you have any idea what kind of lasting damage that commercial would do to you, to your reputation?
I never thought I'd be 39 years old still talking about it. I'll tell you that much right now. But I quickly started to become aware that you're not going to shake that. I didn't know. But more than not knowing the damage it would do, I didn't know what the actual statement was. It's a weird thing. I was doing a commercial, and a girl that I had known my whole life who had just come back from college, and she looked so beautiful when I saw her, and she showed up there, and I was thinking more about Wendy than I was thinking about what some guy wants me to say into a camera lens. And when I get done, she even asked me what that was all about, and I said, "I don't know. It's just some line for a camera. It's images everywhere. They're taking images, and it's an image on the screen, and you know, whatever." And certainly I came to regret that. It was a few months later that it became what I was identified with and what haunted me, whether I was doing well on the court or whether I wasn't.
And didn't reporters keep throwing that back at you? I mean, especially when you weren't doing so well, that you were all flash and no substance?
Yeah, reporters, peers, fans, you know, they would yell it from the audience if I was falling apart at the seams. They'd tell me, "That's all right, image is everything." You know, if I was winning, it was like the comments they'd make was always kind of built around this something that I just felt, you know, certainly wasn't what I wanted to be.
Now, you also talk about some of the top players you didn't especially like Boris Becker, who accused you at one point of, he said the Pro Tour was catering to you. He called you elitist, said that the other players didn't really like you. And this got really personal for you, didn't it?
And I didn't know how to deal with that. And one of the ways you can do it is to repress it. But what I chose to do with it that summer when he said those things was turn it into some anger, use anger as a motivator and focus on him. And, you know, there's no secrets between me and Boris as to what we went through. You know, we had beers together late after he was retired, and we had good laughs about it because it's all pretty much juvenile. You know, it's long ago and juvenile in many respects. But it's one of those things that you have to tell because it left an indelible mark on me. What was really formative was how I channeled it and how I used it, and then how I didn't get over the line at the U.S. Open, and all this emotion and all this anger going 26-0 to that U.S. Open final and then losing to Pete, how all of that meant you were a loser. You're 26-1 and you feel like a loser, and that to me was a real meaningless kind of existence.
Hmm. Now, what people always said about Pete Sampras is that he gave his whole life to tennis. He was 100% committed to tennis. And tennis was clearly not your whole life. You had tremendous ups and downs throughout your career. And I guess looking back, I mean, do you have any regrets about not dedicating yourself to tennis the way Sampras did?
No, I don't have regrets about that. I have regrets about a lot of things. You know, I'm glad I found my peace with tennis. That would have been a crime for things to have ended prematurely as it related to me appreciating the game and what it had given me. But winning and adding more titles, you know, I never identified with athletes who did that. It's not something I understood. At times during my career, I wished for his sense of clarity or his sense of focus or his lack of need for inspirations. But for me, it just wasn't in my DNA.
Andre Agassi, talking with Steve Paulson about his memoir called Open. If you'd like to hear more from Andre Agassi about his epic rivalry with Pete Sampras, how a tennis match can turn on a single point, or why he and his wife Steffi Graf decided not to build their own tennis court, you'll find the complete, uncut interview on our website at ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's a long way from a tennis court to the dangerous streets of Baghdad. But war has its own paradoxes. As Washington Post reporter David Finkel discovered, many American soldiers could hardly wait to feel firsthand the adrenaline rush of combat. But all too often, the actual experience of war turned into a nightmare. Finkel is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the book The Good Soldiers, an account of the 8 months he spent embedded with the soldiers of Battalion 216, who went to Iraq in 2007 as part of the surge. Finkel's book is an unforgettable portrait of the soldiers he met there.
I don't think there was any soldier who loved the idea of being in a war more than Adam Schumann, who, by wide acknowledgement, was one of the great soldiers in this battalion. This was Adam's third deployment. He had been in Iraq for about 1,000 days, and during the first deployment, when it was all about warfare and not counterinsurgency, which was the strategy of the surge, it was all firefights, it was all soldiering. And Adam Schumann talks about how being in a firefight was the sexiest feeling in his life.
At one point in your book, he says it was a front seat to the greatest movie I've ever seen in my life.
Well, it gets at where he began in all this and the journey to where he ended up. And what happened to Adam finally, if I can tell a quick story, is that there was a point early in this third deployment when there was a firefight, when snipers were afoot, and a sniper shot a soldier named Michael Emery in the back of the head on a rooftop. Critical injury. No one could quite maneuver Michael Emery down three sets of stairs so he could be taken to an aid station. So finally, the great Adam Schumann threw Michael Emery across his back in a fireman's carry and carried him down the stairs. It just so happened that the way he carried them meant that all of Michael Emery's blood went into Adam Schumann's mouth, which he kept spitting out as he went down the stairs. 6 months later, Adam Schumann was still tasting that blood, and he had reached the point where he simply couldn't be a soldier anymore. And when I caught up with him is when he was about to go home.
He was, as you say, a tough and resilient soldier. In fact, he was the one they would turn to in that situation, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. And he felt terribly guilty about leaving, but he had become a bit suicidal in his thinking. He was keeping a journal. His entries were getting increasingly dark. And finally, he did the thing. He asked for help. And when people heard what was going on, they realized this very good soldier had to go home.
Were you there with him right at the end?
I was with him. I spent probably the last 2 or 3 days of his deployment with him. What I saw in front of me was a sad, guilt-ridden, great, hurt young man who had no choice but to go home.
One of the other men that you got to know in Battalion 216 was Jay March. He was another soldier who started out gung-ho, as most do, and didn't realize, I think, for quite a while how bad the war would become.
He got an idea of it, as did all the soldiers, when they first got off a helicopter in the middle of the night in eastern Baghdad. And as light broke and they looked out of a guard tower, they saw nothing but piles and piles of burning trash. And they wondered how in such a landscape they were going to find all the roadside bombs that were planted out there specifically and deliberately at U.S. soldiers. Then one day, one of the bombs exploded right in front of where Jay March was riding, killing a friend of his. What happened next is Jay March and some other soldiers went running and following a wire to see who had set off this roadside bomb. And it finally took them into a house and into a back room where two soldiers, Jay March was one of them, found a man who was kneeling and then turned and had a weapon in his hand. And so they fired. And Jay March watched as the man he had just shot, the bullet went in the top of his head and he fell forward. And then he sensed a motion and heard a screaming and looked to the right, and there cowering was a girl about the age of his little sister back in Ohio who had watched him shoot this man in the head. And Jay March was having a very difficult time for weeks and weeks and weeks getting the image, actually a series of images, out of his head of what his war had become. Shooting a man, seeing the man falling, looking to his right and seeing a little girl screaming and realizing the little girl had watched him shoot a man in the head.
This was a very good soldier, too. Jay March was a very good soldier who was trying to do the right thing.
And continues to be a good soldier. He's still in the Army. He stuck with it. But that was the day that any kind of idealism and romanticism about what he was headed into took a true, realistic turn.
You're talking about a group of men for whom clearly you have strong feelings, who all went into this war for a variety of reasons. Some of them really looked forward to being great soldiers. Some of them really believed in the mission in Iraq. Some of them really felt that this was an act of patriotism. Some of them joined simply as a way to get out of what appeared to be a dead-end life at home. But it sounds as though what you're describing is an experience that no matter what they started with, changed them.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And it's not a surprise that war changes a person. The question becomes, how are they changed? And who are they at the end? And what are they left with? Not every soldier in this battalion was hurt, of course. Some 800 soldiers, 14 died. Probably 10% received Purple Hearts for what they did, in a few cases for some minor injuries, but in most cases for very substantial injuries. But then there's also the mental injuries that occurred and that in some cases continue to occur. They ended up in a brutal place. I'm sure it wasn't the worst place in Baghdad, but it was far from the best. And what happened to them over their 14 months on the ground has left them really quite bruised. And a year later, over a year later, I get emails from the soldiers all the time telling me what's going on. The next one who got arrested for drunk driving, or the next one who can't seem to sleep anymore, or the next divorce case. And, you know, look, these are pretty common stories in any battalion.
And then there is the commander of Battalion 216 who has experienced all of these things with all of the men. And what is it he says? It's good?
Well, it's a lieutenant colonel named Ralph Koslerich, a very, very good tactical soldier, a bright man, and an amazingly optimistic man, which is probably a good thing when you're leading a battalion of young soldiers into a war. And every day that I was with him, Koslerich would find some reason to say the phrase, "It's all good." Even after something bad, he would just try to find the good corner in this. And it wasn't just a matter of spin. This is out-and-out belief that they were there for a valid reason. They were doing great work, and what they were doing was all good. In all the time I knew him, there was only one day, I don't think he said it. Do you mind if I tell about the day?
I suspect it's going to be when he visited the Surgical Research Burns Center in Texas.
Well, yes. What happened, this was in January 2008, and Ralph Kosarich had come home for 18 days of leave. And at the end of it, he decided to go visit his injured soldiers at Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio, Texas. There were probably a dozen soldiers in recuperation there, missing arms, missing legs, one case missing an eye. And then there was Duncan Crookston, who was a 19-year-old soldier who on September 4th, the previous September 4th, which happened to be the day that President Bush landed in Australia and was overheard saying to the deputy prime minister who asked about the war how well it was going, that in fact, I think the phrase was, we're kicking ass. That was the day that in eastern Baghdad, a Humvee was hit by a roadside bomb. Three soldiers died. The fourth lost both his legs. And the fifth, Duncan Crookston, lost both legs all the way up, lost his right arm at his shoulder, lost most of his left arm, and what was left of Duncan was very badly burned. But he didn't die. He was airlifted out to Landstuhl and then finally to Bamsey in San Antonio. And I guess it would be 4 months later, Ralph Kosarich caught up with him. At that point, Duncan had endured 30 surgeries. At one point, his eyes were sutured shut because of infection. His ears had fallen off. Most of his nose had fallen off. His eyebrows were gone. His eyelids were gone. The flaps on his eyes were opened again, and what he was wearing was a set of self-misting goggles that left droplets on the inside so that anything that Duncan saw would come swimming into his view. And into his view one day came Ralph Kosarich, who looked at Duncan, or what was left of Duncan, and that was the day, instead of saying it's all good, he just kind of muttered, wow, and then he said, bastards, and then he went over to talk to Duncan. What happened after that? Ralph Kosarich spent time with Duncan and his great family, left the hospital, flew back to Iraq to continue the deployment, got to his office, signed on his computer, and there was a message waiting from Duncan's mother that said Duncan had finally just died.
We all know, or think we know, that war can be brutal. There isn't anybody who's going to question that. But these are stories of returning soldiers that we just don't hear very often.
Well, but I guess the point is that the stories are there, not just in this battalion, but any of them. These things happen. It's not news that war is a bad thing or that bad things happen in a war. It's just the way war goes. Nonetheless, what happened to these guys, their transition from the initial optimism they had to the men they turned into 14 months later deserves its airing and its telling as part of the full story of what this war has meant.
That's David Finkel talking about his book, The Good Soldiers. Finkel is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The Washington Post. Our theme this hour is the fine line between opposites. For instance, how love and hate can be so closely intertwined with each other. Dorian Sagan and Tyler Volk have written about another pair of apparent opposites. Their book is called Sex and Death, or Death and Sex if you flip the book upside down. Sagan is a science writer who's written the sex part. Volk is a biologist who's tackled the other half, on death. And together they've written a scientific and philosophical, and also playful, meditation on the deep connection between sex and death, which led Anne Strangechamps to wonder...
Do you ever wonder about the chicken and egg question? Which came first, sex or death?
If you define sex, as some biologists do, as genetic recombination leading to a new organism, or just as, even more simply, as genetic recombination, you could argue that there may have been nucleotides on the early Earth or even elsewhere in the solar system that were mixing before there were true cells, which is the minimal unit of life. So theoretically and sort of paradoxically, you might argue that sex could have come even before life. So That would be one answer to the chicken and eggness of it.
Yeah, that's interesting, Dorian, because I would have said death would have to come first because the cells were dying out of necessity, not that they had to die, but that there would not be enough nutrients to support infinite reproduction. But your point is very well taken, that in the pre-life stage, the mixing of nucleic acids to create what we now know as life could be seen as kind of a part of sex. Yeah, good point.
Well, you write your book and I'll write mine.
Yeah. At face value, sex and death would seem to be opposites. You know, one marks the beginning of the life cycle, the other brings it to a close. Your book suggests that they're actually much more linked than we realize. Tyler, you wrote the book, the half of the book on death. One of the points you make in the book is that we are literally, all of us, dying all the time, that something like, 100,000 cells are in the human body die every second?
Yeah, die every second. So we are really these giant beings that live because there is death going on. So death on these smaller scales of the cells supports our lives on the larger scale.
So we're really programmed to die in every possible sense.
Yeah, the programming happens literally in the cells. So our skin is continually sloughing off. That's the most obvious example. The skin is completely renewing itself about every lunar cycle, about every month. It takes about 30 days for the skin to renew itself. And other parts of the body renew themselves over longer durations or shorter durations, as the case may be. There's cells in our immune system that die if they don't hook onto the parts of the blood that are trying to harm us, let's say either bacteria or other kind of toxic agents. But on the big scale, our bodies are, the programming is a more difficult concept with the large scale body because we're not really programmed to die at a certain age, but we do senesce, we do run down because it has not been worth the evolutionary process enough effort to make our lives longer.
But aren't we supposed to die in order to make room to get out of the way of other generations? Isn't that, evolutionarily speaking, isn't that our job?
Well, I guess as some of us get older and older and draw upon Social Security someday, the younger generations may really wish that the older ones would die as quickly as possible and get out of the way. But that's not the evolutionary reason for death, because it would really serve the evolutionary purpose of reproducing and carrying on your genes to live as long as possible and reproduce as much as possible. However, to keep us alive, to keep our bodies alive, requires cellular repair mechanisms that we have, but some creatures, such as birds, seem to have them even better than mammals do. Birds of the same body weight live much longer than mammals, and it's been shown that they have certain kinds of repair mechanisms in their bodies that mammals do not have. And that costs something in the evolutionary sense. And so there's a trade-off between putting the energy of the body into reproducing as much as possible early on in life versus using some of those resources to keep the body alive for a long time in hopes of reproducing perhaps at a slower rate at an older age. The example I love that shows this so clearly is the example of the 8 species of Pacific salmon in the northwest U.S. and up in Alaska and Canada that die after reproduction, after mating. Once they've lived in the ocean and have grown to their mature size, they migrate back up to the stream of their birth, which is really extraordinary. They probably can do this through sensing the chemistry of the water of those particular streams. But they go upstream, you know, we think of the salmon swimming these rapids, trying to get over the ladders across the dams, and they change their bodies enlarge, they turn color, the males grow these special jaws, and when they get way upstream and they mate, they die soon after that. And that shows that it was not worth it to have them swim back to the ocean and do this again. It was more worthwhile to put all their effort into this one fantastically arduous swim and mating and be done with it then.
That's Tyler Volk, co-author of the book Sex and Death, talking with Anne Strainchamps. We wanted to give the last word to his co-author, Dorian Sagan, who wrote the half of the book dealing with sex.
One of my favorite quotes is one of the epigraphs. It's from Tallulah Bankhead, "I am as pure as the driven slush."
I prefer the one from G.K. Chesterton.
Yeah, that's a great one.
No, it's not G.K.
Chesterton. It's Lord Chesterfield. in the 18th century in his letters to his son on the art of becoming a man of the world and a gentleman, cut to the chase in a sentence still not bested, quote, "The expense is damnable, the pleasure momentary, and the position ludicrous."
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Sex and death, love and hate. This hour we're talking about apparent opposites and how closely they can be connected. Laura Waterman knows this intimately. She adored her husband Guy. You might say they were soulmates, inseparable for nearly 30 years of marriage. But Guy became almost unbearable to live with as he sank into a profound depression. Then one day he hiked to the top of one of his favorite mountains in New Hampshire, in the middle of winter, and sat down to die in sub-zero temperatures. What makes the story especially poignant is that Laura knew he was going to do this. In her memoir called Losing the Garden, she searches to answer the question, how could she let her husband kill himself? To find out what she discovered, Steve Paulson went to see Laura Waterman at her home in eastern Vermont.
Laura Waterman's memoir consumed me like few other books I've read. Knowing the ending certainly pulled me along, but it's actually a story bursting with life, and Laura's husband, Guy Waterman, is one of the great characters of recent decades, a driven, obsessed, gifted man, but also someone crippled by inner demons. Laura and Guy were back-to-the-land Vermonters before it was fashionable, living off the grid for 29 years, while also writing a series of hiking and climbing books. In so many ways, they carved out an exemplary life together. So how do we explain the suicide at the end? That's the question that haunted me when I went to see Laura Waterman in East Corinth, Vermont. Laura lives in a log house and keeps a huge flower garden just outside her front door. Inside, the house is filled with mementos, including an ice axe over the wood stove and dozens of pictures of her life with Guy.
Let's see. One shows us cutting down a very large ash tree it was. Then there were some climbing pictures.
Laura met Guy Waterman in 1969, just after she discovered the thrill of rock climbing. Guy was already an avid climber. Both were living in New York City. He wrote speeches for GE executives. She worked in publishing. But their hearts were elsewhere, on the side of a cliff.
It was as close as we humans can come to flying. I guess climbing can become addicting, and I became addicted from my first climb.
Guy and Laura were soon spending all their time together, climbing on weekends and dreaming of the day they could live out in the country. It turned out they both loved books as well, and Guy had actually memorized most of Milton's Paradise Lost.
And I was very impressed with that.
So what was the attraction to Paradise Lost for Guy?
He was very attracted to the character of Satan, and he admired Satan's individuality, his refusal to be pushed around.
Laura and Guy hadn't originally planned on becoming homesteaders. They just wanted to live cheaply near the mountains. After they got married, they bought a small piece of land in the Vermont countryside, and inspired by Thoreau's Walden and Helen and Scott Nearing's Living the Good Life, they set about becoming completely self-sufficient. They even gave their place a name, Berra, and Guy soon started his own Book of Berra, where he laid out his objectives.
To live simply, cheaply, unhurriedly, concerned with basics like food and shelter and fuel, and to maintain our interest in climbing and hiking.
Well, it's also striking the kind of home that you set up. I mean, no electricity, no running water. You ended up using an outhouse for 29 years. And in fact, what all this cost, it's amazing how little your expenses were. I mean, you say that you lived on $200 a month for years, and then with inflation, that kind of crept up to about $250 a month, which came to about $2,400 a year over nearly three decades. Well, not too many people can do that.
Well, I think people can do just about anything that they set their mind to doing. And we did find a way of supplementing what we had in the bank with writing.
So what was a typical day like? Can you run me through your schedule?
Yes, because we did have a schedule. Guy always got up at 4:15 precisely, but I was not an early riser. And usually we were out of the house and working by 8 o'clock. And then we would spend from 8 till noon either doing garden work or wood collecting, or if it were sugaring season, we'd be down at the sugar shed. Or maybe we would be writing for the morning.
Now, what's fascinating is a lot of people would consider this very onerous. I mean, just nonstop work, what some people would call chores, hour after hour. But you say that Guy would describe this as playing in the woods.
Well, he said that kind of play that you have as children, if you can find it as an adult, you know, you'll be happy. I mean, as he said to me, that he'd found someone to play in the woods with.
Well, you say there was another ritual, daily ritual, that you had together, and that was reading books out loud after dinner.
Yeah, it started because, as a guy called me, I was president of the slow eaters. And it's true, I'm a very slow eater. And he was a very fast eater. So he would finish his dinner and then begin reading.
This sounds like such a throwback to a 19th century lifestyle. It's almost as if you had dropped out of the 20th century.
Well, I think we really had.
Guy Waterman was the kind of man who needed to throw himself into big projects. One of the biggest was climbing every 4,000-foot mountain in New Hampshire in the winter from all four directions. It took him years, but he did summit all 48 peaks four times each, often bushwhacking his way up the mountain through snow and ice when there were no trails. To say Guy was driven would barely begin to tell the story. He was also an obsessive record keeper, recording and measuring everything they did, how many potatoes and carrots they gathered in their garden, how many cords of wood they collected, every bird they saw and book they read. They had three thermometers in different locations, which they checked several times a day, and they kept meticulous records of rain, snow, and wind.
It was a control thing for him. I mean, it pushed out bad thoughts or pushed away what was probably a depression for him.
Guy never used the word depression to describe his increasingly bleak moods, but he did talk about his demons and did everything he could to keep them at bay. Playing the piano seemed to help. In fact, the music we're now listening to is a recording of Guy from the mid-70s. Playing the Steinway Grand he'd squeezed into the cabin was one way he could pour out his feelings when words failed him. Guy Waterman had been married once before, a marriage that produced three sons. He taught all three to be expert rock climbers. But two of his sons, Bill and Johnny, became deeply troubled, and both died tragically young. Johnny's death during a solo climb of Alaska's Mount McKinley hit Guy especially hard. Earlier, Johnny had made a nearly impossible ascent, spending 145 days alone on Mount Hunter, a mountaineering feat that made him a climbing legend in Alaska, but left him feeling empty.
The way he looked at it was that if he was able to climb it by this extremely challenging route, that somehow it wasn't a worthy mountain.
The only worthy mountain would be one that would kill him.
That's correct.
And you say that Guy saw a lot of himself in Johnny.
Yes, well, that's what Guy said.
So why didn't Guy ever go to Alaska to try to help Johnny? Laura can only guess.
Guy couldn't face it. I think by trying to find out what Johnny's problems were, then he would have had to have faced what his own problems were. He couldn't do that. We never used the word depression, but it seems that Guy fell into a pretty profound depression after Johnny's death.
Did you talk about this with him, about how difficult life had become?
We tried to talk about it, but it was very difficult. You know, talking to me or trying to articulate what he felt just wasn't something Guy wanted to take on.
What about you, though? I mean, this must have been very hard for you once he started spiraling downwards. I mean, this must have affected your marriage.
It was hard. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, I thought, do I want to stay being married to Guy? And, you know, and the answer was yes. I mean, I really couldn't imagine not being with him.
Well, there are, I think, a couple of great mysteries in this story. One is why Guy never went for help, never to see a therapist, never to get some kind of psychiatric intervention. Why not?
He'd had a very bad experience with, you know, with a psychiatrist when he was a teenager. I think he was so burned by that earlier experience that it just wasn't a possibility. I don't think he could really confront what was so scary to him. And I think that he felt a great guilt and also shame.
Do you think he also felt responsible for the deaths of his two sons?
He never said he did, but I don't see how he could have not felt some responsibility.
Now, the other great mystery, as I read your book, was about you. It was about why you didn't insist that he get help when it was so clear that he was deeply troubled. Why didn't you haul him off to a psychiatrist?
Guy wasn't the sort of person that you hauled off to a psychiatrist. I mean, certainly we talked about it, and he said no. If I had pushed on it, it would have broken up our marriage.
One day in 1998, Guy Waterman came back from a summer hike and, clearly shaken, told Laura that he'd climbed to the top of a cliff, intending to jump off, but couldn't. Laura was stunned, though not completely surprised, and told him if that's what he had to do, she had to be in a better place herself before he committed suicide.
I really think that that was the right thing to say to him. I mean, I wasn't saying, you can't do this. You know, if that's going to be your path, I have to make sure that I'm in a path that's satisfying for me. So in a sense, it opened up communication between us. And, you know, we spent close to 18 months. We had 18 months together after that.
Laura and Guy spent the next year and a half saying goodbye to each other and the life they'd built together. They even designed a new house 2 miles away, which they called Laura's house, for the time when Guy would no longer be here. Laura says it was actually a healing time for both of them. And for all that she wished he would change his mind, she knew he wouldn't. And in some ways, that was also a relief. Guy did all he could to help her get ready for being on her own, and he left her a note.
Which was basically saying, I know you'll do your life well. It gave me permission, in a sense, to not feel guilt. I think the worst thing for me would have been if he had actually managed to jump off of Cannon Cliff that July 3rd.
Finally, on one of the coldest days of the year, February 6th, 2000, Guy hiked to the top of one of his favorite mountains in New Hampshire and froze to death overnight. It's the one day Laura still isn't able to talk about, though she offered to read a passage from her memoir about their last morning together.
The morning Guy leaves, what seemed like any ordinary winter morning to someone looking in the window of our small cabin in the clearing. I prepare our hot cereal of road oats, wheat germ, raisins, dried milk, and maple syrup on the wood stove. Guy dishes out applesauce, which I canned that fall. Our voices are low as we sit at the table, the usual easy back and forth. He springs up, ever the fast eater. He wants to be off by 8. I watch him slide in his 2 canteens, one with water, the other holding half alcohol and half water, to make the job easier, as we've talked about. The sight of him within touching distance on the ash log is so utterly familiar that I can't make it real that in a few moments my husband is going to walk out the door for the last time. This time, you won't be coming home to tell me the tale, how it all comes out, I say, and send him a small smile. He looks up and grins back, and I feel the connection between us deepen. I won't even be able to send you a postcard, he says, continuing the joke. And when he looks up again, the concerned look is back, and he says, make bread today, Laura. I stare at him, thinking this is a strange thing to say, but in fact, the old loaf is down to a few stale slices. We need bread, or rather, I will need bread.
Guy Waterman's memorial service turned out to be one of the biggest the local village had ever seen. And Guy, being Guy, had planned for the occasion. A few months earlier, he sat down at the piano and recorded the music he wanted for his service, the music we're now listening to. The ceremony turned into a celebration of Guy's life.
I was just so stunned by that outpouring for Guy after his death. I mean, the number of letters that I received, and, you know, there was just a huge amount of love. I mean, in a sense, that was a really sad part about it, because that love had been there all along, and he really was not able to accept that.
It's now been, what, 9 years since Guy died. You've written a memoir. You've obviously thought about this a great deal. How do you look back on your marriage with Guy now?
Well, it seems strange to say, but in a way, I wouldn't have changed anything. He was the person for me.
You describe it as the great love story.
Well, maybe it was.
Laura Waterman's memoir is called Losing the Garden, The Story of a Marriage. All the music in this piece was played by Guy Waterman. Steve Paulson talked with Laura in East Corinth, Vermont, in the house she designed with Guy shortly before his death. Today, Laura Waterman hikes and gardens and writes, and is an active member of the Waterman Fund, a nonprofit group that supports education and stewardship of the alpine areas in the Northeast. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, send us an email through our website at ttbook.org or visit us on our Facebook fan page. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the Love-Hate Show, number 1213A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, and Doug Gordon. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.